Chapter 50. David Robert Vaughan's room was a 12-foot cube, painted dark green below a narrow cream waist-high band, and light green above. It was warm. It had a small, sooty window. It had a green metal cabinet and a green metal footlocker. The footlocker was open and held a single pair of clean pajamas. The cabinet was stacked with file folders and oversized brown envelopes. The envelopes were old and torn and frayed and held X-ray films. The room had a bed. It was a narrow hospital cot with locked wheels and a hand-wound tilting mechanism that raised the head at an angle. It was set to a 45-degree slope. In it, under a tented sheet, leaning back in repose like he was relaxing, was a guy Reacher took to be David Robert Vaughan himself. He was a compact, narrow-shouldered man. The tented sheet made it hard to estimate his size. Maybe 5'10", maybe 180 pounds. His skin was pink. He had blonde stubble on his chin and his cheeks. He had a straight nose and blue eyes. His eyes were wide open. Part of his skull was missing. A saucer-sized piece of bone wasn't there. It left a wide hole above his forehead, like he had been wearing a small cap at a jaunty angle, and someone had cut all around the edge of it with a saw. His brain was protruding. It swelled out like an inflated balloon, dark and purple and corrugated. It looked dry and angry. It was draped with a thin, man-made membrane that stuck to the shaved skin around the hole, like saran wrap. Vaughan said,
"Hello, David."
There was no response from the guy in the bed. Four IV lines snaked down toward him and disappeared under the tented sheet. They were fed from four clear plastic bags hung high on chromium stands next to the bed. A colostomy line and a urinary catheter led away to bottles mounted on a low cart parked under the bed. A breathing tube was taped to his cheek. It curved neatly into his mouth. It was connected to a small respirator that hissed and blew with a slow, regular rhythm. There was a clock on the wall above the respirator. Original Army issue, from way back. White, bakelite rim, white face, black hands. A firm, quiet, mechanical tick once a second. Vaughan said,
"David, I brought a friend to see you."
No response. And there never would be, Reacher guessed. The guy in the bed was completely inert. Not asleep, not awake, not anything. Vaughan bent and kissed her husband on the forehead. Then she stepped over to the cabinet and tugged an X-ray envelope out of the pile. It was marked Vaughan, D.R., in faded ink. It was creased and furred. It had been handled many times. She pulled the film out of the envelope and held it up against the light from the window. It was a composite image that showed her husband's head from four different directions: front, right side, back, left side. White skull, blurred gray brain matter, a matrix of bright pinpoints scattered all through it.
"Iraq's signature injury," Vaughan said. "Blast damage to the human brain. Severe physical trauma, compression, decompression, twisting, shearing, tearing, impact with the wall of the skull, penetration by shrapnel. David got it all. His skull was shattered and they cut the worst of it away. That was supposed to be a good thing. It relieves the pressure. They give them a plastic plate later when the swelling goes down. But David's swelling never went down."
She put the film back in the envelope and shuffled the envelope back into the pile. She pulled another one out. It was a chest film. White ribs, gray organs, a blinding shape that was clearly someone else's wristwatch, and small, bright pinpoints that looked like drops of liquid.
"That's why I don't wear my wedding band," Vaughan said. "He wanted to take it with him, on a chain around his neck. The heat melted it, and the blast drove it into his lungs." She put the film back in the stack. "He wore it for good luck," she said.
She butted the paperwork into a neat pile and moved to the foot of the bed. Reacher asked,
"What was he?" "Infantry, assigned to the 1st Armored Division."
"And this was IED versus Humvee?" She nodded.
"An improvised explosive device against a tin can. He might as well have been on foot in his bathrobe. I don't know why they called him improvised. They seem pretty damn professional to me."
"When was this?"
"Almost 2 years ago."
The respirator hissed on. Reacher asked, "What was his day job?"
"He was a mechanic, for farm equipment, mostly."
The clock ticked relentlessly. Reacher asked, "What's the prognosis?"
Vaughn said, "At first it was reasonable, in theory. They thought he would be confused and uncoordinated, you know, and perhaps a little unstable and aggressive, and certainly lacking all his basic life and motor skills."
"So you moved house," Reacher said. "You were thinking about a wheelchair. You bought a one-story and took the door off the living room. You put 3 chairs in the kitchen, not 4, to leave a space." She nodded.
"I wanted to be ready. But he never woke up. The swelling never went away."
"Why not?"
"Make a fist."
"A what?"
"Make a fist and hold it up."
Reacher made a fist and held it up.
"Okay. Your forearm is your spinal cord, and your fist is a bump on the end called your brainstem. Some places in the animal kingdom, that's as good as it gets. But humans grew brains. Imagine I scooped out a pumpkin and fitted it over your fist. That's your brain. Imagine the pumpkin goo was kind of bonded with your skin. This is how it was explained to me. I could hit the pumpkin, or you could shake it a little, and you'd be okay. But imagine suddenly twisting your wrist very violently. What's going to happen?"
"The bond is going to shear," Reacher said. "The pumpkin goo is going to unstick from my skin." Vaughn nodded again.
"That's what happened to David's head. A shearing injury. The very worst kind. His brainstem is okay, but the rest of his brain doesn't even know it's there. It doesn't know there's a problem."
"Will the bond reform?"
"Never. That just doesn't happen. Brains have spare capacity, but neuron cells can't regenerate. This is all he will ever be. He's like a brain-damaged lizard. He's got the IQ of a goldfish. He can't move, and he can't see, and he can't hear, and he can't think."
Reacher said nothing.
"Battlefield medicine is very good now. He was stable and in Germany within 13 hours. In Korea or Vietnam, he would have died at the scene, no question."
She moved to the head of the bed and laid her hand on her husband's cheek, very gently, very tenderly, said,
"We think his spinal cord is severed too, as far as we can tell. But that doesn't really matter now, does it?"
The respirator hissed, and the clock ticked, and the IV lines made tiny liquid sounds, and Vaughn stood quietly. And then she said,
"You don't shave very often, do you?"
"Sometimes," Reacher said.
"But you know how."
"I learned at my daddy's knee."
"Will you shave David?"
"Don't the orderlies do that?"
"They should, but they don't. And I like him to look decent. It seems like the least I can do."
She took a supermarket carrier bag out of the green metal cabinet. It held men's toiletries, shaving gel, a half-used pack of disposable razors, soap, a washcloth. Reacher found a bathroom across the hall and stepped back and forth with the wet cloth, soaping the guy's face, rinsing it, wetting it again. He smoothed blue gel over the guy's chin and cheeks and lathered it with his fingertips, and then set about using the razor. It was difficult. A completely instinctive sequence of actions, when applied to himself, became awkward on a third party, especially on a third party who had a breathing tube in his mouth and a large part of his skull missing. While he worked with the razor, Vaughn cleaned the room. She had a second supermarket bag in the cabinet that held cloths and sprays and a dustpan and brush. She stretched high and bent low and went through the whole 12-foot cube very thoroughly. Her husband stared on at a point miles beyond the ceiling, and the respirator hissed and blew. Reacher finished up, and Vaughn stopped a minute later and stood back and looked.
"Good work," she said.
"You too, although you shouldn't have to do that yourself."
"I know."
They repacked the supermarket bags and put them away in the cabinet. Reacher asked, "How often do you come?"
"Not very often. It's a Zen thing, really. If I visit and he doesn't know I've visited, have I really visited at all? It's self-indulgent to come here just to make myself feel like a good wife, so I prefer to visit him in my memory. He's much more real there."
"How long were you married?"
"We're still married."
"I'm sorry. How long?"
12 years. 8 together, then he spent 2 in Iraq, and the last 2 have been like this."
"How old is he?"
34. "He could live another 60 years. "Me too."
"Were you happy?"
"Yes, and no, like everyone."
"What are you going to do?"
"Now?"
"Long term?"
"I don't know. People say I should move on, and maybe I should. Maybe I should accept destiny like Zeno, like a true Stoic. I feel like that sometimes, but then I panic and get defensive. I feel, first they do this to him, and now I should divorce him. But he wouldn't know anyway, so it's back to the Zen thing. What do you think I should do?"
"I think you should take a walk. Right now. Alone. Walking by yourself is always good. Get some fresh air, see some trees. I'll bring the car and pick you up before you hit the 4-lane.
"What are you going to do?"
"I'll find some way to pass the time.